This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting, and the taste? Lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
It was October 12, 1880, at the Massiot House in Springfield, Massachusetts. A group of college men gathered to decide the future of the sport that was barely a sport at all. What they had played that fall looked nothing like the game you watch on Sundays. 22 men on the field, or sometimes 25 or 30, depending on who showed up. No line of scrimmage, no downs, no quarterback, just a mass of bodies fighting over a ball, something closer to warfare than football. And into that room walked a 21-year-old Yale man named Walter Camp. And by the time he was finished, he hadn't just changed the game, he had built it from the ground up, one rule at a time. Our first story doesn't start with Walter Camp. It starts with chaos. In 1876, the colleges of the Northeast gathered in Springfield for the Massiot Convention. The same hotel, the same room where Camp would one day seize control of the game. They bent there to adopt the common rules. The code they chose was rugby. Harvard had played a visiting Canadian team from McGill University 2 years earlier and had fallen in love with the rugby style. The convention voted rugby it would be. But the rules they adopted were barely rules at all. 15 men to a side, no defined line between offense and defense. The ball was advanced by kicking, carrying, or laddering it backwards, never forward. And if a runner was tackled, the ball was simply tossed into the air and both teams scrambled for it. This was rugby's scrummage, and it was violent, unpredictable, and often pointless. Games routinely ended in scoreless ties because neither team could establish possession long enough to mount an attack. The sport was dying on the vine. Spectators stayed home. Newspapers mocked it as a brutal exhibition, and between 1875 and 1880, at least four colleges dropped football entirely. Then Walter Camp arrived. Walter Chauncey Camp was born in 1859 in New Britain, Connecticut, and by the time he entered Yale, he was an excellent halfback, fast, clever, and by all accounts, nearly impossible to tackle in the open field. But his real gift wasn't on the field, it was actually in the committee room. At the 1880 Rules Convention, Camp arrived with a radical proposal, and the votes to pass it. Yale had brought in more delegates than Princeton and Harvard combined, and Camp knew exactly how to use that to his advantage. Rule number one was the line of scrimmage. Camp proposed a radical idea borrowed from no other existing sport. A fixed, imaginary line that separated the offense from the defense before every play. The ball would be placed on the ground at that line, and a team in possession would put it in play from there. No more rugby scrum, no more chaos, and for the first time, football had a defined moment when a play began. It wasn't just a rule change, it was a creation of a line of scrimmage itself, the single concept that makes American football structurally distinct from every other sport on earth. Every snap you've ever watched, every quarterback who's ever taken a cadence, every false start penalty, it all traces back to that vote on October 12th, 1880. Now, if you're going to have a line of scrimmage, you might need the second rule, the snap. You need a way to put that ball in play. In Camp's solution, the center would use his foot to heel the ball backwards to a teammate, usually the quarterback. And it wasn't a spiral snap as you see today. It was an awkward, clumsy ball rolling more than often on the ground than it flew. But it was the birth of the snap, and with it, the birth of offensive structure. A third rule was the amount of players on the field. How about 11 men? Camp reduced that number of players from 15 to 11 per side. This was more controversial than it sounds. Fewer players meant more space, more speed, more strategy, and the less brute force out on the field. Harvard and Princeton argued that the 15 men was a standard and that reducing that number would fundamentally change the character of the game. Camp's response, in essence, was, "That's the whole point of it." And what happened next took nearly 2 years to play out, and it almost killed the sport. In 1881, the new rules created an unintended catastrophe. You see, the line of scrimmage and the snap had given the structure to football, but they'd also given a fatal flaw. A team that gained a lead, even a tiny one, could hold the ball at that line of scrimmage, snap it backwards and do nothing over and over again for an entire half. There's no rule forcing a team to advance the ball, and so they didn't. The press called these block games. Yale and Princeton played to a scoreless tie in 1881 that was described by the New York Times as, quote, a contest in the art of standing still, unquote. Spectators who had traveled hours by train to watch football instead watched 60 minutes of men leaning on each other. The game was becoming a joke. So at the 1882 convention, Camp proposed a rule that would become football's genetic code. A team in possession of the ball must advance at 5 yards within three attempts or surrender possession altogether. Three downs to gain 5 yards. Fail, and the ball goes over to the other team. It's difficult to overstate how radical this was. Camp had just invented the most fundamental tension in American sport, the down and distance problem that has haunted offensive coordinators for 140 years. Third and two, fourth and inches. Every clutch conversion in football history exists because Walter Camp decided that standing still wasn't good enough. Before 1883, there was no standard way to score in a football game. Different colleges used different systems. A touchdown might be worth 2 points at one school, four at another, and a field goal might be worth nothing at all. Camp standardized it. A touchdown, 4 points. A goal from the field, five. A safety, two. A goal for a touchdown, two. This was a numerical system. Touchdowns, field goals, safeties, extra points. It is the direct ancestor of the scoreboard that you look at today. The numbers have changed, and the concept is Camp's. But here's the thing that doesn't get talked about enough. Every one of these rules was opposed. Every single one. Camp was not some beloved elder statesman gently guiding the sport forward. He was the most controversial man in the game of football. To understand how Walter Camp built football, you have to understand how the rules were made and unmade. The game was governed by the Intercollegiate Football Association, founded in 1876. Representation was weighted by the number of colleges each school could bring to the convention. Yale, under Camp's direction, recruited smaller colleges into its voting block. Schools owed Yale favors or shared its vision for a faster, more strategic game. By 1882, Camp controlled enough votes that he could pass almost anything that he wanted. Princeton and Harvard fumed. They accused Camp of turning football into a Yale game. They weren't wrong. Rule number six, the seven-man line and the quarterback. Camp formalized the positions on the field, seven men on the offensive line, a quarterback behind center to receive snap, two halfbacks and a fullback. This was a T formation before anybody called it that. It created specialized roles, blockers, runners, signal callers, rather than 11 men all doing roughly the same thing. Signal calling was another rule that Camp came up with. He introduced the idea that the quarterback would call signals at the line, or words, numbers that told his teammates what play was coming. And this was revolutionary. For the first time, football had a strategy rather than just action. A play just wasn't a run, it was called a run, an audible, and a design deception. By mid-1880s, the transformation was nearly complete. The chaotic rugby hybrid of 1876 had been replaced by a structured, strategic, recognizably modern game. But the sport had a problem that Camp's rules couldn't resolve. And that problem was the violence. Between 1880 and 1905, football was dangerous in a way that's hard to fathom today. The flying wedge, a formation where blockers locked arms and charged downfield as a unit, turned the line of scrimmage into a human battering ram. Players died. In 1905 alone, 18 young men were reported as being killed by playing football. President Theodore Roosevelt summoned the college presidents to the White House and demanded reforms. That's when rule number eight came in, legalizing tackling below the waist. Camp had long supported low tackling as the safer alternative to the rugby-style high hits that caused head injuries. His logic, if you tackle a man at the legs, he falls forward. If you tackle him at the head, he may not get up. It was a safety reform wrapped in a tactical innovation. Rule number 9, creating a safety position. Camp designed the safety as the last line of defense, a player positioned deep behind a line who would tackle any runner who broke through. It was the game's first truly defensive innovation, and it changed how offenses attacked. A running back who cleared the line was no longer guaranteed a score. Rule number 7, the neutral zone. Camp codified the space between the offensive and defensive lines, the neutral zone. It was a no man's land. It was exactly the length of a football, and neither side could enter it before the snap. This was pure camp. Order imposed on chaos, geometry imposed on violence. But there was one rule Camp did not want, the reform he fought with everything he had, and he lost. Walter Camp believed that football was a game of running, blocking, and territorial warfare, not throwing the ball over people's heads. The forward pass, he argued, was a gimmick. It rewarded luck over skill. It would turn football into something unrecognizable, at least to people of that era. He was the most powerful man in football, and for years he won. The forward pass was rejected at convention after convention, largely because Camp opposed it. But the violence crisis changed the calculus. After Roosevelt's intervention in 1905, the Rules Committee, now expanded beyond Camp's Yale voting bloc, voted to legalize the forward pass in 1906. It was restricted, awkward, and heavily penalized. That was Camp's influence. An incomplete pass was a turnover. A pass that hit the ground was a turnover. But it was legal all the less. Now, rule number 11, the forward pass. Camp's unintended legacy, and here's the irony that echoes through football history. Camp's resistance to the forward pass may have made it better. The restrictions he insisted on, the ineligibility of certain linemen, the requirement that the passer be behind the line of scrimmage, the penalty structure, shaped the forward pass into a precision weapon rather than a random heave. The modern passing game, every spiral you've ever watched, every route combination, every quarterback's mechanics exists within a framework that Camp helped build by his restrictive rules he imposed, even as he tried to prevent the forward pass from being legalized. He lost the battle, but the war, in hindsight, was his. Now, Rule 12 brought on Camp was an All-American team. In 1889, Camp collaborated with Casper Whitney to publish the first All-American college football team, a selection of the best players at each position across the country. It was a publicity innovation, not a rule change, but it mattered enormously. The All-American team created a national conversation about the game of football. It gave fans heroes to follow. It turned a regional college pastime into something approaching a national obsession. And it was, in its way, Camp's most enduring creation. The NFL draft, the Heisman Trophy, the entire apparatus of football celebrity, the stars, the rankings, the debates, and who belongs on what list. All of it descends from Camp's annual All-American selections. Before Camp, football players were anonymous. After Camp, they were legends. Now, Walter Camp never coached in the NFL. He never played on television, never signed an endorsement deal, and never heard a stadium of 80,000 people roar for a fourth down conversion. But every snap those 80,000 people watch, that's his. The line where the quarterback stands behind, that's his. The down and distance that makes your heart race on third and two, that's his. The scoreboard, the positions, every shape on the field, all of it traces back to that 21-year-old at the Massillon House, fighting in a room full of men who didn't want the game to change. He didn't just change football. He invented the game you're watching. Now, thanks for joining us today. You can find more great football history at your portal to Gridiron History, pigskindispatch.com, and enjoy everything that we have coming out here on YouTube and in podcasts and on pigskindispatch.com, where we have many games that you can play that are focused around a game of football and our very in-depth American football timeline, where you can look up almost anything you want, and it's building more and more every day. So all the events from 1869 to 2026 season and beyond as we grow in a game of football. We're here to share your passion with the game, and we want to be there all the way with you. So make sure you join us. Subscribe if you can. Hit the like, and we'll see you next time. Have a great Gridiron Day.
Hi, this is Joe Ziumba. and I'm the host of the podcast When Football Was Football here on the Sports History Network. This podcast is based on stories, events, and characters from my book called When Football Was Football, The Chicago Cardinals and the Birth of the NFL, which was written shortly after the Cardinals won their last championship in 1947, or so it seems. The reason for this message is twofold. First, to share the great news that the second edition of the book has just been released by McFarland Publishers, and all Sports History Network listeners can now enter a special Sports History Network contest for the opportunity to win one of two free copies of When Football Was Football. We'll be happy to include a personal inscription in each winner's book and then send it out to you with our best wishes. The new book contains about 80 more pages than the original, almost all new archival photos, additions within all chapters based on new research, and an update on the players, coaches, and administrators mentioned in the book. It's everything you ever wanted to know about the early Cardinals, as well as the NFL itself. To enter this free giveaway, go to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. Thank you.